Huh. That's it. That's the macroeconomic headline today, just, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 30th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The through line of this economy this week is going to be jobs. The August monthly unemployment report comes out on Friday. This morning, we got the July job openings and labor turnover survey, JOLTS for short. And as I said up in the open, the response, I mean, really, this was it. It was just, because we learned, among other things, that the number of open jobs in this economy went up in July, 200,000 or so, to a total of 11.2 million available, which is most emphatically not what anybody had been expecting, given all the other stuff going on out there. And more to the point, not what Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed are trying to make happen out there. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino gets us going.
Aside from the surprise jump in job openings, this JOLTS report doesn't look all that remarkable, says Kate Bonn, chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. The number of workers who quit, got hired, or laid off didn't change all that much.
So I think we're seeing it's more of the same.
But more of the same is not really what the Federal Reserve is going for. It's been trying to cool down the economy with interest rate hikes. So a persistently hot job market is bad?
It is absolutely reasonable to be confused.
Economist Betsy Stevenson at the University of Michigan says, of course, more jobs are good for workers.
It has been a time of unprecedented opportunity for people to find the right job for them.
But when workers have a lot of options, that can drive up wages, which can drive up prices, then wages, then prices. Basically, exactly what the Fed is trying to avoid, says Mark Hamrick, a senior analyst for Bankrate.
This suggests that interest rates could be going higher from here,
which raises the risk of a recession. Hamrick says the Fed will be watching closely this week for signs the labor market is balancing out, like, say, if more people joined the workforce to help fill all those open jobs. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Also going up in this economy, home prices, not quite as fast as they have been for much of the past year or two, but still up they go, 18% higher in June than they were a year earlier, so said the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index out today. And along with those prices often come higher rents, which is starting a whole lot of conversations in city and state governments about limiting some of those rent increases. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
There are two main ways governments tend to regulate rent increases, if they do at all.
Rent control is essentially a ceiling on rent.
Claudia Aiken at the Housing Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania says that generally means the landlord can never raise the rent above a certain dollar amount.
More recently, rent control usually takes the form of something called rent stabilization, which is a limit on the annual rent increase.
So a landlord can only raise the rent maybe 2, 3, 4% a year.
It is fantastic for current renters that basically have this wonderful insurance against very high rent increases in the future.
Christopher Palmer at MIT's Sloan School of Management says one of the problems with rent control or stabilization is it's not means tested. So
it subsidizes tenants without regard to whether tenants have the means to pay for market rate housing on their own.
And it can sometimes exacerbate the housing supply problem.
By discouraging new construction or by leading landlords to take existing rental housing out of the market.
Sophie House at the Housing Solutions Lab at NYU says it's a tricky line for cities and states to walk.
What, if anything, can be done to protect tenants from destabilizing rent hikes while doing as little as possible to discourage new rental housing?
Setting some kind of relatively generous cap on rent increases can work well, House says, especially if it's combined with more housing subsidies for low-income people. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, this isn't necessarily going to make anybody feel better, but the slide in equities since Friday, that's what the Fed wants to be happening. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In that funny way that gotcha politics in this country has of getting all up in economic policy, the Paycheck Protection Program was back in the news last week. The PPP, that early pandemic program that offered forgivable loans to mostly small businesses to let those businesses keep staff on payroll while the virus had its way with this economy. Forgivable loans, of course, brought to mind for many President Biden's student loan forgiveness order of last week. We are going to do business loans here today, though, having sent Marketplace's Justin Ho off to check back in with some small business owners who got PPP loans to see how things have been going for them.
It took a while for Sherrard Duvall to get a PPP loan for his video production company in South Carolina. 4 months after submitting its first application, OTR Media Group finally got its check. Back then, Duvall told me that he used the money to pay workers and settle bills,
which freed up our ability to go, okay, now that some of that debt is gone, let's look at recalibrating selling and advertising. Let's look into doing the website.
By the time he got the loan, Duvall's video production work had dried up. So the company started a new line of business, setting up live streaming equipment in home offices, businesses, and churches. Today, Duvall says that business has been doing great ever since.
Almost every week, we were either doing an install, or we were doing a training, or we were sending a crew out to an office, or hiring a crew to go somewhere to some like a live venue.
Meanwhile, video production work has come back, so Duvall's been expanding the company. In May, almost 2 years after getting his PPP loan, Duvall took out a small business loan to purchase video equipment to help the company meet demand.
Had it not been for the success we've had since the pandemic, I would not have gotten that loan in May.
Duvall also hired more staff, and he wants to build out some office space, so he's preparing to take out yet another loan.
We may have to purchase a place, or we may have to put down a large enough amount in advance on a leasing space so that we can make adjustments to the physical space on the inside.
The pandemic forced a lot of businesses to evolve. Before the pandemic, Naomi Pomeroy ran a restaurant in Portland, Oregon called Beast. Diners ate a fixed menu for roughly $175 a person. The James Beard Award-winning chef says the whole thing wasn't very COVID-friendly.
People sat literally like almost shoulder to shoulder with people they'd never met before for 2.5 hours eating the same thing at the same time. And that was super fun, but I couldn't see a way forward with that for quite a while.
So Pomeroy closed the restaurant and used her PPP loan to pivot into a new business. Ripe Cooperative sold meal boxes that people could cook at home, along with pastas, sauces, and salads. But then, in the spring of last year, restaurants started reopening.
You know, as soon as people started getting vaccinated, I was having a lot of FOMO, honestly, with my friends who had these like big outdoor patio spaces.
So last November, Pomeroy turned Ripe Cooperative into a cafe. She used some of her leftover PPP money to expand her own outdoor patio. Pomeroy says the cafe is a lot less exclusive than her old restaurant, but she likes that. The challenge has been turning a profit.
Now the model is very, very different because it's a cafe and we have a lower check average. So it's busier feeling to us, but it's making about, you know, a little less money actually.
Turning a profit has been especially challenging for restaurants because costs are up throughout their supply chains.
You know, we're the end of that. And so we see all those increases by the time we purchase the products.
That's Mark Fryer. He owns two restaurants in Vermont.
And then we have to turn around and try to make a profit. It's tough right now.
Fryer used to own a third restaurant, along with a music venue. He says his PPP loans kept all three of his businesses alive early in the pandemic. But late last year, between higher costs and new COVID variants, he closed the restaurant and music venue.
You know, that music venue had been there for 50 years. And I felt terrible being the one to close it, you know, but there was really no other option. We were still carrying the cost of that space, even though we weren't able to make a dollar.
Fryer says the outlook for his remaining restaurants is pretty grim. He says he can't keep raising prices to cover costs. Meanwhile, it's been difficult to find workers, so he has to close his restaurants one day a week.
We would love to get back to a 7 day a week. We can't seem to figure it out with staffing, so we continue to remain closed for a day.
Which means he's got to cover all of his expenses for the week in just 6 days instead of 7. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace. Thank you.
Don't look now, but Russia is about to squeeze the European natural gas market again. Moscow's device of choice is the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, which sends gas from Russia to Germany and which is going to be shut down for maintenance again, starting tomorrow through, in theory, Saturday. But honestly, any mention of maintenance with that pipeline these days is fraught because nobody knows for sure when the spigot might be turned back on. And what with sanctions and colder weather coming and Russia being Russia, there's a whole lot up in the air. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
The price of natural gas in Europe is almost 12 times higher today than it was at the beginning of 2021. And most European consumers are feeling it.
The bills are going up and up and up.
Anna Maria Jeller-Makarevich with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says Europe is bracing for an even bigger shock once winter begins.
Lots of consumers will go into energy poverty because they won't be able to afford all of these gas prices.
Ahead of winter, some European countries have managed to come close to filling their storage facilities. Germany's are more than 80% full. France's are at 90%. That could ease prices, but according to Moritz Kuhn of the University of Bonn, even full storage facilities won't solve Europe's energy problems.
And the reason is that relative to all the demand that we are going to see, they are just too small.
Kuhn says some European countries, most notably Germany, have invested in finding alternative sources, but they still depend on Russia, which means Vladimir Putin. Many are watching to see if state-owned Gazprom brings Nord Stream 1 back online this weekend as planned, says Daniel Fried, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council.
Putin loves to keep people guessing. It makes him feel powerful. And in the short term, right now, he can succeed in doing it.
France, for one, is now preparing for what it calls a worst-case scenario, a complete interruption of flows from Russia. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If it didn't succeed, it was taking me down. I was personally going to go bankrupt and have to start all over.
And that is no good at all. But first, let's do the numbers. Also no good is what happened on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials down 308, about 0.9%, 31,790. The NASDAQ down 134, about 0.1%, 11,883. The S&P 500 gave back 44 points, also 0.1%. 39 and 86. We heard from Megan McCarty Carino today. The job openings rose to over 11.2 million. Well, and HR-related stocks, Kforce dropped 2.5% today. Upwork down 1.3%. Kelly Services sank about 2.9%. Sales at Best Buy, the electronics retailer, dropped about 13% in the second quarter as people spending shifted away from electronics. Best Buy up 1.6%. Nonetheless, competitor Target lifted about 1.3%. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 3.11%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I mentioned this last week, I think, that something like 20 million households in this economy are behind on their utility bills. The catch, of course, with not being able to pay for that is that gas and electricity, I mean, you can't just go without them, right? And meanwhile, the companies in charge of getting you that electricity and gas are just that. They're companies with bottom lines to worry about. Bottom lines, though, that as you're about to hear, take second place to nothing. Catherine Blunt takes a well-known, infamously well-known, in fact, California utility and makes it nationally relevant in her new book. It's called California Burning, The Fall of Pacific Gas and Electric and What It Means for America's Power Grid. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can we jump to the subtitle of this book? It's called The Fall of Pacific Gas and Electric and What It Means for America's Power Grid. Can you talk for a second about the rise of Pacific Gas and Electric, just the infrastructure that it inherited over the past century? Because that seems to me to be germane to some of the most high-profile incidents in this book.
Absolutely. So PG&E merged with another company back in 1930 that had built a lot of transmission infrastructure all throughout the Sierra Nevada foothills in Northern California. And a piece of one of those century-old towers failed in November of 2018 and ultimately dropped a live wire that sparked the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California history. And when you think about America's power grid as a whole, there's a lot of it that is considerably old, decades old, if not century-old components. And as a result, there are elements of our grid that are becoming more prone to failure, especially as climate change creates new stresses on the grid.
Well, yeah. So let me jump to what I had thought was going to be the last question, but we'll put it up here at the top. And I'll continue with the subtitle theme. What does it mean for America's power grid? Because we need electrical power all the time, but we also need to be not investing in coal burning, natural gas fired, you know, all those expensive fossil fuels. We need to go green. We need to change our infrastructure. But we're dealing with stuff that's decades and centuries old.
That's right. Utilities all across the country face a big challenge at the moment in greening the system, transitioning to cleaner forms of energy, as you say, as well as upgrading the grid to replace some of this decades-old infrastructure. And electricity is something we need all the time, and we're going to need more of it going forward.
Okay, so let's get to PG&E specifically and some of the incidents laid out in this book. There are some deadly wildfires caused by PG&E equipment failures. There is a natural gas explosion from a failed pipeline up in San Bruno, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And you describe a scene where executives at PG&E are going over a PowerPoint in the aftermath of that explosion. And they're talking about things that were up for debate. Literally, that's the phrase. This is up for debate. And these things are not up for debate. Set that scene for us and tell us what was and was not up for debate for Pacific Gas and Electric.
Sure. So this PowerPoint occurred shortly before the natural gas pipeline explosion. Okay. But there was an offsite meeting in which executives pulled up a PowerPoint, and they had one PowerPoint slide. And what was not up for debate was 8% annual growth in earnings per share. What was up for debate was safety and reliability. And
I'm sorry. Say that again, because it sure sounded like you said that the company decided that profits were not up for debate, but safety was.
That is what is implied on this slide. Yeah. And this PowerPoint slide came to light as evidence in a trial that ultimately proved PG&E's criminal culpability in this explosion. And a lot of the other evidence that came forward did a lot to show that PG&E was putting profits over safety for a number of years.
Why is it so hard for us to draw the line, clear boundaries between utility, right? Everybody needs electricity, and a business, if that question makes sense. You know what I mean?
Sure. No. The majority of our power is provided by what we call investor-owned utilities. And they are kind of strange hybrid businesses, so to speak. They are publicly traded corporations. They are beholden to shareholders, but they are also regulated entities that provide a critical service. And it's tough. I mean, the nature of the business historically has created tensions between those private interests, shareholders, and the public good.
So let me say that this is it's a good and fast and engrossing read, and I don't want to get down too far into the weeds of the legal trials and tribulations of PG&E because it's only a half-hour radio program that we've got. But do you think – so I would encourage people to read the book is why I said that. But do you think that anything has or will change systemically because of what has happened with PG&E?
Yeah. So there's no question in my mind whatsoever that the new leadership team understand the risks throughout the system in a way that they never have before. And they understand the consequences of mismanaging that risk. The new CEO, for example, came in and introduced a new strategy in which she's going to try to bury 10,000 miles of power lines so that they can't ignite fires. And theoretically, that is a great idea, but it comes with a lot of challenges. There are financial challenges, or labor challenges, engineering challenges. I think certainly the desire is there. It's just there's a practical reality to contend with as well.
And we have to say, it ain't just California, right?
That's right. No, it's not. The topic of how do you transform any given utility system to account for new risk is becoming a very relevant topic throughout the entire country.
It's a book called California Burning. Catherine Blunt wrote it. She is by day an energy reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Catherine, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time, and I enjoyed the book.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
I saw this in the Wall Street Journal last month, that up to 30% of dry cleaners, most of them mom and pops, have gone out of business since the pandemic started. The ones who are making it through, though, aren't completely in the clear quite yet, as you'll hear in today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Joe Runyon. I live in Kansas City, Missouri, and I own Hangers Cleaners. When we first initially opened in 2004, and the stores were not generating enough volume to justify the size of a processing plant that we had. So purely out of desperation, we purchased a van and rolled it through the neighborhood where I grew up and where I lived, and suggested to people, mostly people we knew, that, hey, if you'll put a bag out on this day, we'll deliver it back to you. And just give us a credit card. We'll put it on file. We'll just charge your credit card. You don't even need to come to the cleaner. Well, we didn't anticipate it, but that just exploded. And so we grew like crazy that first year. And probably 70 to 75% of our piece count volume comes through our pickup and delivery service. People know us by our vans. We put, you know, funny pictures on the back of the vans. And anyway, it just becomes very recognizable. It becomes a great rolling billboard as it goes through neighborhoods that we want to serve. And so our pick and deliver service has been really kind of our calling card, and it's kind of what has established us in Kansas City. The biggest issue I think we're facing now, and is issue 1, 2, and 3, is labor. We just cannot find people who are interested in working. And the employees that we do have, we've got several employees that have been with us for 15 years or more, which is great. I love that loyalty, and it feels like a family here. But there are limits as far as what we can pay and still, you know, have a viable business. You know, we've had to pay quite a bit more because they have legitimate offers to go to other businesses and make more money. And I don't blame them. So we try to stay ahead of the curve, but man, when we lose somebody or we need someone because of growth, it becomes very, very difficult to find somebody to fill those gaps. When I started Hangers, if it didn't succeed, it was taking me down. I was personally going to go bankrupt and have to start all over. And so what my next step is, I don't know. Honestly, I mean, I've got some ideas, but you know, right now this business has me challenged. There's other things I've got on my mind that I know that I'll dip my toes into at some point.
Joe Runyon out in Kansas City, Mo. You know, I say this every time we run an installment of this series, and it's as true now as it ever was. We cannot do it without you. So please go to marketplace.org/myeconomy and let us know what is going on with you. This final note on the way out today, follow along with me if you would. I said up at the top of the program that falling stocks are part of what the Fed wants to happen as it tightens up on getting inflation under control. Interest rates go up, the economy slows, less business for businesses, stocks go down. Good so far, right? Well, here is another thing that happens when the economy slows. We use less oil. Crude today, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate off $5, about 5.5%, 91 and change a barrel. All right, we're out of here, but not, of course, without your moment of economic context. I'm going to keep it petroleum-themed just because I can, I guess. A gallon of gas today, national average, $3.84. I personally got $4.79 yesterday in L.A. I was pretty happy about that. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.